I'd like to dedicate the shiur today to the Zecher Nishmat in memory of Ora's husband, who passed away last week. Ora, if you could tell us, what's his Hebrew name?
Yosef Feibel Ben Natan.
Yosef Feibel Ben Natan. All right. The Shema should have an aliyah, should benefit from our learning. Okay, so last time around, we were talking about, we talked about the fig cure, this fig that Yeshaya prescribes to cure the shchin that Chizkiyahu is experiencing. We talked about what that was exactly about. Was it a natural cure? Was it not a natural cure? And it leads to his request for a sign from God that he is going to be healed and he's going to go to the Beit HaMikdash. And we noted already last time that this is moved within the story as it appears in Yeshaya, meaning the commentators, other than perhaps Rashi, agree that the chronological order of events is what's in Malachim, which is to say that first, I'll just call up my own Malachim here. There we go. First, Yeshaya says to him that Hashem is going to add 15 years. Then Yeshaya has the fig used to cure his shchin. Then Chizkiyahu asks, do I have a sign? What sign do I have that God is going to heal me? And Yeshaya gives him a sign. That's the way it works in the account that appears in Malachim. Whereas in the book of Yeshaya, that's not the way things work. In the book of Yeshaya, as we have been reading, I'm just trying to juggle all the different texts that we're working with. But in Yeshaya chapter 38, he becomes ill, he prays to God, he gets the message that he's going to get another 15 years, and then he is given the sign. Then he sings a song of thanks to God, and then we're told about the fig cure, and then he asks for a sign. So it's all out of order. So one of the things we're going to talk about is why this is out of order. Why is it placed at the end of the chapter? Before we move on to what the sign actually was, and this, the shadow and the clock and all of that. But just to review again, what is this business of Chizkiyahu requesting a sign at all? Because we rushed through it at the end last week. So Rashi said that he's not actually requesting a sign. He is exclaiming in wonder at the sign that he has been given. In which case, you could actually say that he's not out of order. This whole chapter isn't out of order. The problem with Rashi's approach is just then, why in Malachim is this in the exclamation in the middle? In other words, you can't have it both ways. You can't justify the order as it appears in Yeshaya and then deal with the order as it appears in Malachim. But that was one approach. Second approach was Ralbag, and Ralbag's approach was that Chizkiyahu is not questioning that God can do this, he's questioning himself. How do I know that I am worthy, that Hashem is actually going to do this for me? Maybe Hashem's help is conditional, and it only happens if I achieve a certain level, and I won't be worthy of that. That's why he wanted a sign that Hashem is going to do it no matter what. That was our second approach. And then the third approach, Radak, Abarbanel. Sorry, Bria?
Yeah, wasn't this conditional upon him getting married and having children?
So it appears not. Meaning,
and that was a prerequisite.
Right, so it doesn't seem to be, neither in the Pesukim, which don't mention anything about getting married at all, nor in the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't say that it was conditional either. The Gemara presents it, it's very interesting, but the way the Gemara actually presents it is that the 15 years are a response not to the commitment to get married, but to the tefillah, to the fact that he davened. Hashem says, I heard your prayer.
Okay.
You know? And then we noted, he also says, I'm doing this for the sake of David, and for, there's more to be said. It's not clear cut to say that it's one or the other, but the dominant influence seems to be his prayer.
The fact that he was going to die early was because he didn't get married.
Correct.
The punishment was because he didn't get married and have children.
So that's the question, is fundamentally, how do I read that Gemara? Is this really a punishment? Or is this simply a stimulus to get him together with Yeshaya and ultimately set a live a child? Like, what? At the end of the day, I do not have a clear answer on what would have happened if he had gotten married and not davened.
Ah, I see.
What would have happened at that point? Would Hashem have been satisfied?
The tefillah had more of an impact on his than his actual action of getting married, and therefore, the reason he was punished in the first place.
The Gemara notwithstanding, you can't get away from the fact that the text says, Shamati es tefilasecha, ra'isi es dimasecha. Right? I heard your prayer, I saw your tears, I'm going to add 15 years. So that's the challenge. Radak gave us, and Abarbanel said it, a third approach, that Chizkiyahu was questioning Yeshaya's seriousness. He thought maybe Yeshaya was just trying to make him feel better. So the fig treatment and all that, maybe that's really all I'm getting. So those were our three approaches to why he asked for a sign. But now...
Oh, also went to the Midrash.
Right, so Susan's addition has a medrash that it's meant to increase God's fame. That's going to be more relevant, I think, to something we'll see later on in terms of the sign that's actually going to play out with where I suspect that medrash is not actually talking about asking for a sign. I suspect that medrash is, if it's the one I'm familiar with, is talking about what's going to happen, the dialogue between Yeshaya and Chizkiyah, in which Yeshaya says to Chizkiyah, what kind of sign do you want? And Chizkiyah is going to ask for it to be a particular way. I think that's the medrash that they're quoting. I don't think it's really about this. I don't have your edition. But I think that's true. We'll see. We'll see it in a little bit. I don't want to confuse everybody. I only want to, at any given shear, it's good to have not more than 50% people be confused. I think is, a good balance. So, if I can just, I don't want to ask for a show of hands about who's confused yet and then, use that to gauge. But I think on balance, I'm better off not jumping ahead with it. Okay. So we've seen the request for a sign. Whether again it's truly a request for a sign, Rashi thinks it's not. Whether it's a request for a sign, I don't believe I'm worthy. Whether it's a request for a sign because I don't know if he's just trying to make me feel good. Those are all different options. And just to go back to Breuer's point, I looked back in my notes. What we had said initially with when Hashem added the years was the Gemara, when saying that he is answered because he is going to have an heir, is picking up on the fact that in Malachim it says, I'm saving you for your sake and for the sake of David. But even that Gemara can't be denying that it says, I have heard and seen your tefillah, your tears. That's in Malachim and in Yeshaya. So that's why we have this odd sense that on the one hand he's fixed the problem, and on the other hand it's about the tefillah. Okay, so why is this stuck at the end of our chapter? After he has gotten the sign, now he's going to do this? Now he's going to ask? That doesn't make any sense. So Radak asks that question. If you take a look at your sheet,
I don't understand your question.
My question is this. In the version of it that appears in Malachim, everything is in chronological order. Hashem promises him, you're going to have 15 more years. He says, how do I know? Right? He gets the fig treatment first for the Shechin. He says, how do I know? However you take that request for a sign, how do I know it'll be for me, whatever. And then you have the whole sign that plays out with the sun and the sunlight moving backward or whatever exactly happens. We haven't yet gotten there. That makes sense. But when you read Yeshaya chapter 38, it doesn't go in order. When you read Yeshaya chapter 38, instead, he is told you're getting the 15 years. He gets the sign. The whole sunlight thing. He thanks Hashem. which we still have to get to. He gives this beautiful poem. And then he says, what sign do I have? So that's, you know, the fig tree, and then what sign do I have? So why in Yeshaya is it thrown at the end? Look at the Radak in source number one. He's at the end of our chapter. Vayomer Yeshayo, and Yeshayo said, this is with the fig thing. So he says, the following verse is not from the Mikhtav. The Mikhtav is the song of thanks that Chizkiyahu offers to Hashem. So he says, this verse about the fig thing is not from that song, which immediately precedes it. And he says, I haven't found a reason for why it was written here, after the Mikhtav. It belongs above. He says, I don't know why. And so it is in the book of Malachim. And in fact, if you look at Malachim, you'll find it to be in the proper place in the chapter. So Radak says, huh, yeah, this doesn't fit here. And then he moves on. Like, he doesn't give us anything to work with. That's it. Okay, fine, next. That's Radak. I like a commentator who knows how to say, I don't know, this is a problem, and doesn't try to paper it over. He says, yeah, this is weird. But Abarbanel suggests something that is very interesting, that requires a bit of a preface. Sorry, was there a question? Okay. Yeah, Shoshana. You have to unmute yourself. I'll unmute you.
I did not succeed. Okay, what will I say in one chapter? Because I want to see.
Yes, right. Okay, so let me now reiterate what I've been saying for a few weeks, which is, if you're in here and you're not getting the emails for this class, please make sure to email me so I'll be able to send you the source sheets in advance. I will be glad to add you. For anybody who is just joining now, we are in Yeshaya chapter 38, but the parallel is in Malachim Bet, chapter 20.
And you can put your email in the chat.
Yes, you can email me, or you can put the email into the chat. You can do it as a private message in the chat. Yes, but yeah, please.
And you can see, and I'll get into Rabbi Zorchin also.
Okay, yes. All right. Okay. So, the Abarbanel floats a very interesting idea, which requires a bit of explanation. There, Moish joined. See, Moish? It's not an app, it's real. Okay. Abarbanel gives an introduction to the book of Yehoshua, in which he talks about the canonization of Tanakh in general. And what he says is not sort of the standard approach. So that's why I brought you this big chunk of text in source number two. Now, for anybody who's not on the email list, of course, you don't have the source sheet. So what I'm going to do is upload it to the chat and hope that works. I know that it doesn't always work for everybody. For some reason, it doesn't always materialize for everyone, but at least it's an attempt. So, there's a Gemara in Bava Basra, on Daf Tesvav, on page 15 in Bava Basra, which tells us how Tanakh was canonized. I'm just typing in the link so that it will be able to give the source sheet just a second. Okay, it's now in the chat. So, the Gemara Bava Basra Daf Tesvav tells us who wrote each of the books of the Nevi'im, who wrote each of the books of the prophets. The Gemara Bava Basra, when it talks about the book of Yeshaya, says that the book of Yeshaya was written down by King Chizkiyahu and his associates. That's what the Gemara in Bava Basra says. But Tanakh as a whole is canonized by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, by the Great Assembly. And here I want to show you how Abarbanel understands that process. So take a look at source number two, please. And again, it's the sheet is now in the chat, so those who don't have it should be able to download it from there and open it up on their computer.
It didn't come up in the chat.
It came up in my chat. Some people have it. I'm getting thumbs up from some people. It's weird. I don't know the way this works, but for some people it shows up, for some people it doesn't. Enough people have it that I know I sent it. Okay. So, in any case, for everybody else, I'm going to read it out loud so you could also hear it from me. I'm just reading out my translation of it rather than go through all of the Hebrew and English for it. It's a rather long quote. He starts out by dealing with the problem of the book of Yahushua, and specifically the fact that we are told multiple times in the book that something is in a particular place, or something looks a certain way, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day. That's an odd turn of phrase. The Gemara deals with the problem of a book saying something is in a certain place, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day, because the Gemara asks, what do you mean, until this very day? If it's really until this very day, that means that we should be able to see all the things that the book says are until this very day. If it says that there are stones at the Jordan River as a monument to the Jews crossing, and they're there, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day, does that mean that in our day, 5780, 2020, you should be able to go to the Jordan and find those stones there? And that's one question. But Abarbanel is looking at it from a different angle, which is, we are taught that Yahushua wrote the book of Yahushua, except for the parts that are after his death. If Yahushua wrote the book of Yahushua, then why would he say those stones are there until this very day? It wasn't a long time ago. Right? I mean, Yahushua was in charge for 28 years. So would he have said, assuming he wrote this at the end of his career, and I have no reason to assume he did, but let's say he did. So he wrote it 28 years after the Jews crossed the Jordan. Would he have said, and those stones are there until this very day? It's an odd turn of phrase to use, and it appears multiple times in the book. So Abarbanel writes, when I examine the text, I saw that the view that Yahushua wrote his book is very unlikely, because the verses testify explicitly that Yahushua did not write them. It said in chapter 4, sentence 9, when erecting the stones in the Jordan, they have been there until this day. Also, the Bris Milah in chapter 5 in Yahushua, and he named the place Gilgal, until this day. The import of saying until this day must be that it was written long after the events occurred. So that's one reason why Abarbanel has trouble with the Gemara saying Yahushua wrote his own book. He adds another note, which those who learn Shoftim with me will remember. You will also find regarding the portion of Dan. Dan has a very odd portion in Eretz Yisrael, as is described in the end of the Chumash, Yezanek min HaBashan. On the one hand, Dan is given land near the Mediterranean, just above Yehuda. On the other hand, they end up with another portion way up north, the top of the Yarden. That's land that they conquer in the story of Pesel Micha, recorded at the end of the book of Shoftim. Whether it happened in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, the end of the period of the Shoftim, is not our discussion right now. Abarbanel believes it happened at the end. And he says, the text there says, the boundary of Dan left them, and Dan ascended and fought in Leshem. They went way up north to fight for the land up north. And it is known that this was in the days of Pesel Micha at the end of the Shoftim. And this is a dispositive argument that this statement was written only many years after Yahushua's death. And so the texts show Shmuel did not write his book in this same way. He says, I jumped. What he says is this. He says, the book of Yahushua records that the tribe of Dan was living in Leshem. They conquered Leshem. They didn't conquer Leshem while Yahushua was alive. And this isn't from the very end of the book. This is in chapter 19 in the book. The Sefer Yehoshua is what, 24 chapters? 22, 23, something like 24 chapters. He says, Yahushua didn't write Sefer Yehoshua, he says. And he says, I have news for you. The same thing is true for the book of Shmuel. And he goes on to bring proof to that point as well. And he says, and because of all of this, I thought that Yahushua did not write his book. Who wrote it? Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel the prophet wrote it. And also wrote the book of Shoftim. Therefore, you will not find it stated in the text that Yoshua wrote it. Sorry, Yoru, what? Rutash, right. Well, whoever writes Shoftim is going to write Rut as well. That's correct. But he says, there's nowhere in the book of Yehoshua that says, and Yehoshua wrote. It's not like the Chumash, where we're told explicitly, Moshe wrote. So he says, no, Yehoshua didn't write it, Shmuel wrote it. And now he has to come back and acknowledge, but wait a minute, that's not what the Gemara said. The Gemara said Yehoshua wrote it. So he says, and don't be surprised that I've deviated from the view of our sages on this, for even in the Talmud they did not agree on these matters, disputing there whether Moshe wrote the book of Job, whether Yehoshua wrote 8 verses of the Torah. The Gemara itself had debates on this point. He says, not everybody has to agree with that. It wasn't necessarily a definitive conclusion in the Gemara. And he brings you another example of this. He quotes from Divrei Hayamim, from Chronicles. It says regarding David's death and the Devarim, I didn't translate the word Devarim because I wasn't sure here whether it should be words or issues of, matters of, affairs of. So I just left it as Devarim. And the Devarim of King David earlier and later are recorded in the Devarim of Shmuel the seer, the Devarim of Nathan the prophet, the Devarim of God the visionary. This is talking about at the time of David's death, and it's the book of Shmuel. This shows Shmuel wrote his book, Nathan and God completed it, as they, Zechonam Levracha, said, I am amazed that our sages did not bring this verse to support their view. It appears correct to me regarding this, that Shmuel recorded that which happened in his day, Nathan the prophet recorded also on his own, and God the visionary also recorded on his own, each that which happened in his days. And Yirmiyahu the prophet gathered them and compiled them together and arranged the entire book with their words. Yirmiyahu was the one who puts together Shmuel. Otherwise, who collected these accounts of different writers? The text does not say the prophets wrote their words in sequence. Each wrote his own book. We're going to get to why this is relevant to what we're talking about. We're going to get there. I have thus explained... Yes, Bria.
What is the timeline here?
What do you mean?
How much Shmuel wrote Yehoshua.
Yes.
And when was that written?
Okay, so the period of the Shoftim is a period of a few centuries.
Okay.
So he's got a few centuries since Yehoshua's day. Not that he's drafting it from scratch, meaning it can be that there are records he's working with. He's also a Navi. He's a prophet.
So a few centuries later, he compiled it.
Correct. And that would make sense with him saying, and the stones by the Yarden are
right
there, Ad Hayom Hazeh. And the monument with the monument of the Korban Pesach and so on. Correct.
So we're dealing with a long period of time where these records must have been kept somewhere.
Yeah.
The records
of
the bishop, right?
Yes. Okay. So he says, I have thus explained, we're on the fourth line on the second side of the source sheet. I have thus explained that these stories came into the book of Melachim for the story itself, and into the book of Yeshaya for the purpose of prophecies. And these are different purposes. He's now shifted gears. Remember, we've talked about the question of why stories appear in multiple books. Why is it that stories appear in Malachim, in the book of Kings, and then they also show up in Yeshaya, but in different form? Or in Yirmiyahu, but in different form? So he says, the stories come into the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, to tell the story. The stories are recorded in Yeshaya in order to teach the prophecies associated with the stories. And these are different purposes. In truth, in the book of Yirmiyahu, the stories of the destruction are also of this character, meaning the destruction of the temple that are brought in Yirmiyahu. They're really only there for the prophecies. Although these stories come in the book of Malachim like the other stories, the prophet also saw fit to bring them in his book, which he dedicated to his prophecies, not for the purpose of the story, but to convey the prophecies he had declared. In truth, the fact that the story of the destruction and exile appears again in entirety at the end of the book of Yirmiyahu, I didn't want to go into all of the different pieces. It's not that relevant for us. What is extremely relevant is what's coming next. He says, he's talking here about the stories that show up at the end of Yirmiyahu, which are stories of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple, the exile of the Jews, and Yirmiyahu does not figure in them. There are no prophecies in them. So I might challenge Abarbanel and say, why did you record these stories in the book of Yirmiyahu? They belong in Malachim. Is the question clear? The question that he's now dealing with. Why is it that the stories of the destruction show up in Yirmiyahu? You told me that the goal in Malachim is to record stories. The goal in Yirmiyahu is to record prophecy. So why is it that you took the stories from Malachim and put them in Yirmiyahu when they didn't actually involve prophecy? Nothing was added. That's his question. He says, these are simple stories without any mention of prophecies or future telling at all. They themselves are the portions which came at the end of the book of Malachim, copied letter for letter without change. In truth, and logic dictates, these were not the words of Yirmiyahu. He did not write those portions. The end of Yirmiyahu was not written by Yirmiyahu. The proof that shows all of this is that before this portion, before those stories show up, at the end of the preceding passage, it says, up to this point are the words of Yirmiyahu. Well, thank you. This shows the text which follows is not from his words, and so you get to the words I bolded. And it appears that Ezra HaSofer, or the Great Assembly, when they collected the texts and arranged the sacred texts in sequence, saw fit to record at the end of the book of Yirmiyahu those portions, copying them from the end of the book of Kings for two reasons, And so we get to the point. Took me a little while, but I'm going to now unpack and explain what Abarbanel is trying to teach us. Abarbanel believes that when the Gemara says Yoshua wrote his book, Shmuel wrote Shoftim in his book, and so on, that isn't necessarily agreed upon by all of Chazal, by all of our sages, and the text itself indicates that they can't have possibly all done that. It can't be that Yoshua wrote the whole thing for his book. It can't be that Shmuel wrote all of his book. Rather, he says, later prophets came. Nevi'im we know, prophets we know, Gad, Natan, and so on, Yirmiyahu, and they added pieces of it. And he says, Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles, says so regarding the book of Shmuel. It says that the book of Shmuel is composed of Shmuel's work, and Natan's work, and God's work. And the final task, he says, fell to Ezra and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, meaning the sages of the first generations of the Second Temple, the Second Beis HaMikdash, when the Jews have come back from Babel, they've come back from Babylon, those sages are responsible not just for deciding what belongs in Tanakh and what does not, which the Gemara already says that they did, but rather they actually are still editing and adding to the scrolls of these prophets. He's not talking Chumash. He's talking Navi. He's talking about the prophets. Are we clear on that idea? Okay, we understand what Abarbanel is saying. So now, take a look at source number 3, and see how he explains the odd order of things in our chapter. He says, in source number 3, the recorder of the book of Yeshayahu did not mention this within the story, meaning the request for a sign within the story, for it was happenstance and not itself planned, and you'll see what he means by that in a moment. But after the conclusion of the entire story, it said as an explanation, and Yeshayahu said, let them take pressed figs, meaning to say that because Yeshayahu said this, Chizkiyahu said, what sign do I have that I will ascend to the house of God? In other words, what Abarbanel says is that these were not necessary parts of the story. These were not necessary parts of the story. Meaning the request for a sign, the fig and the request for a sign. the member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, what he calls the recorder of the book, the Kotev Sefer Yeshayahu, the recorder of the book, saw that the version of the story he had didn't match what was in Malachim. It didn't include Chizkiah asking for a sign. The way that the story first looked in Yeshaya was Hashem told him, you're going to live, and here is a sign that you're going to live. The request wasn't there. It's not an essential part of the story. It was Yeshaya giving a home remedy with figs for his skin. And it wasn't really so necessary. So he looks at it and he says, well, it appears in the account that's in Malachim. So I guess I should record it in Yeshaya also. But it's not a necessary part of the story, so he puts it in at the end of the chapter. That's Abarbanel's explanation for how Yeshaya ends up looking this way. Again, to make sure that it's clear. The Malachim version of the story has everything in chronological order. You're going to live. Yeshaya does the fig thing for his skin. Chizkiah says, how do I know I'm going to live? Give me a sign. He gets a sign. In the Yeshaya version, that wasn't the way it looked. In the Yeshaya version, it was, you're going to live, and here's a sign, end of chapter. And the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the great assembly, looked at that and said, you need to bring over the piece that's there in the Malachim version of it. We need those two sentences. But they're not essential to the story. Who needs them? Alright, fine. We'll put them in at the end. We'll put them in at the end of the story. They're not so essential. They're not so essential to the story. That's the way that Abarbanel explains this. I don't know whether I am more comfortable with Radak's version, which is, yeah, I don't know why those sentences are there, so let's just move on. Or whether I like Abarbanel's version, which, on the one hand, makes a lot of sense in terms of how Tanakh as a whole was formulated. On the other hand, it takes sort of the sanctity out of the process. Like, you know, it's hard. Yes, Rebecca.
It also, it's not as if Anshei Knesset HaGedola did this all the time. You know, we've seen other variations between the two texts.
Yes.
So in consistency, we say, oh yeah, this is what they were doing.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Abarbanel has done this before. He just hasn't done it as explicitly. But remember, when we talked about the question of why certain details in chapter 38 were here and certain details only appeared in Malachim, we read Abarbanel's explanation where he said, because the goal of Malachim is to tell the stories of the kings. And the goal of Divrei Hayamim, the goal of Chronicles, is to encourage faith in the Davidic dynasty. And the goal of Yeshaya is to give Yeshaya's messages, his nevuot, his prophecy that everything is coming from Hashem. And so each one is going to convey that which is particularly important for it. It's the same, it's built on the same idea, Rebecca. I see the hand.
In that sense, what you just summarized almost argued against what he's saying here.
Like,
I don't have to
look at it. Right. So then the question is, why did he feel like he needed to throw this in? And the only answer I can give is that, well, it helps to show why a sign was given. But I agree. This is hard. But I like his overall point, even if the application here I find difficult. Rabbi Tikhanovsky.
Well, I was just going to say that the logic doesn't actually hold, because if for whatever reason he still had to include those two lines, it doesn't explain why he added them out of order. He still stuck them in the story in the right order if they were necessary to be put in, rather than just to throw them at the end, like almost like purposely to confuse.
Right. Well,
I don't know if the logic holds.
Yeah, no, I agree. This is difficult to say, well, these lines weren't that essential, so therefore I guess I'll just put them in at the end of the chapter where they confuse the reader. Like, let's just see if the reader is paying attention. Because we're at chapter 38, and honestly, you might not be. I don't know. I saw Bruya's hand, and then Professor Sokin.
I was just wondering if he was getting... Abarbanel got a lot of pushback for his general philosophy on this, that everything was written after, that so much of it was written after it was actually happening.
Right. So I'm not a scholar of the field enough to know. I did right away, when I saw this, I wrote to Eric Lowy. Yeah, Professor Lowy, who lived in Toronto, made Aliyah, and is, in fact, he wrote the book on Abarbanel. So, you know, I wrote to him and asked him. Sorry? Okay. So I asked him whether he had anything on this, and he didn't really, you know, have anything in particular to add about this. The... It's such an odd thing, but on the other hand, it's consistent with the Gemara. Meaning, I noted before, the Gemara itself says that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, this great assembly, decided what was in Tanakh and what was not in Tanakh. It has the whole thing about wanting to exclude Koheles, wanting to exclude Shir HaShirim, you know, the debate about including Esther, like, you know, the that's all credited to them. So they clearly have control over what makes it in. But yeah, having them decide, let's harmonize these particular chapters, and we'll do it in such a non-harmonious way, it's odd. Professor Zakin, you're on mute. There you go.
I'm intrigued by all of this. I find it fascinating because Yeshayahu didn't write Yeshayahu, this is out of order, and maybe it was done this way. This is all bringing back to me what the new critics or the historical critics do with the Torah. It's that same kind of thing. And it's astonishing to me to see this all acceptable and par for the course. And yet, of course, we don't do that with Torah because Torah is Torah.
Right.
It's from God. But the idea of doing this is exactly what the historical critics do with the Torah.
Except that it's not exactly what they do, right? What's the big difference?
No, it's not exactly.
No, but there are two big differences, right? Big difference number one is that they do it with Chumash.
Right. They say it wasn't written by God.
You know, and difference number two is that in general they don't feel beholden to answers that are consistent with Tanakh itself.
Right.
Meaning, if they think that the way to resolve a problem is by suggesting an idea that contradicts other parts of the same book, they don't mind that. Abarbanel, and it's not just Abarbanel, it goes all the way back to the Gemara. We have a very, very old history of dealing with problems in the text and textual criticism. But we always worked from the standpoint of whatever answer you give has to be consistent with the text itself. And that's something that the critics don't feel beholden to at all.
Right, they're bringing a different mindset to it.
Right. I mean, I always like to give my favorite example from my great uncle, who was one of these critics. He looks at the beginning of the Chumash. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. Right? As Ibn Ezra translates it, in the beginning of God's creation of the Shamayim and Aretz. Right? And then it goes on to say, the Aretz was tohu vavohu, and it was dark, and so on, and God said, let there be light. So in the beginning of God's creation of Shamayim and Aretz, here's what God did to create Aretz. Well, what about Shamayim? You didn't say anything about what God did to create Shemayim. That's not going to happen until day two, right? That's problem number one. Problem number two is, you mentioned in the next sentence, the Spirit of God is floating above the Mayim, above the water. What water? It was just Shemayim and Aretz. So my great uncle's solution was to say that somewhere along the line, a copyist made a mistake. It should say, Bereshit bara Elokim et hamayim ve'et haaretz. And now everything works really well. He was a very creative man. It's a very creative solution. I don't adopt it at all. I think that there are other ways to deal with the problem, but that's the thing. They're not looking for that. And it's a lot of detective work and a lot of creativity, and it's not responsible to the books. What Abarbanel is doing is he's not in any way taking away from the status of these books as prophecy. If he says Yeshua didn't write it, he says Shmuel did. And he's not taking himself out of the framework of the Gemara either. He says, look, the Gemara itself has a debate. I'm not rejecting the Gemara, but the Gemara itself isn't so sure. The Gemara itself allows for the idea of multiple authors of a book. So he's still within the system, so to speak. That's what I see. Shoshana, you were going to say?
Yes, I want to ask a question. I understand that when you have different versions of stories, you need an explanation, but I want to go to the first one of Melachim, and I'm sorry if I go a little bit out of the class. Maybe you talked about it. When God, I think this is a very big question, at least for me. When God tells the king, you will be cured, and the king is asking for a sign, not believing God, that's for me a great question.
So, yeah, this was our entire topic for the last hour last week. That was what I was summarizing in the beginning this week when I said in the very beginning of the class today that we had these three different approaches. Either he's not asking what sign, he's not asking for a sign. He's saying, Ma, what a great sign. Like, Hine Matovu Manaim Shevadachim Gam Yachad, and Ma like that, that was Rashi. Or the second approach, he's saying, what, can God give me a sign that I will deserve this, that God is going to do this for me? Because we have a tradition throughout Tanakh of people saying, sure, God can do a nes, but who says he's going to do it for me? Maybe I'm not worthy, like Gidon. Or the third idea, which was that he thinks Yeshaya is trying to make him feel better, but it's not actually going to happen. Yeshaya is just trying to calm him down. Those were the three explanations. If you go back, when you send me your email address to add you to the email list, Blineder, I'll also send you a link to catch the recordings of the classes before this so you can catch up. Okay, I want to go further here because there's so much going on. Also, I want to make sure to note, I said it in the email that I sent out for the class. We're not having a shiur next Tuesday. Those who are interested in learning next week, I will be more than glad. There are shiurim going. I'm giving shiurim almost every day next week. I think only Tuesday night I don't have, but I have pre-Shavuot shiurim Sunday night, Monday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday afternoon. So, Blineder, I will send out links so that you can catch all of those opportunities, but we will not have a Yeshaya shiur next week. Okay, so let's go further here, because we need to know what this sign exactly is that he actually ends up with. It's not simple and straightforward. So here what I want to do is read to you what we have in Yeshaya, and what we have in Melachim, and what we have in Divrei Hayamim, because it's important to see all of this. So in Yeshaya chapter 38, you want sentences 7 and 8. 38, 7 and 8. Lamed Chet, Zayin and Chet. V'zelecha ha'os me'eis Hashem. This is the sign from God. Asher ya'aseh Hashem es hadavar hazeh asher diber. That God is going to do what He has said He's going to do. Here is your sign that Hashem is going to heal you. You're going to go back to the Beis Hamikdash and all that. Hineni meishiv es tzel ha'ma'alos asher yarda v'ma'alos achaz b'shemesh achoranis eser ma'alos. He says, I am going to bring the shadow on the degrees. The degrees, it means like a sundial, where you tell time as the sun casts a shadow. I am going to return backward the shadow on those degrees, on the sundial, that which has descended on the degrees of Achaz, father of Chizkiyahu. Backward 10 degrees. Vatosha v'ashemesh eser ma'alos b'ma'alos asher yarda. And the sun descended 10 degrees. That's the version that appears in Yeshaya. Very bland, right? Very straight. Yeshaya says, here's your sign. the sunlight is now going to go back up 10 degrees on the sundial, and that's what happened. It's not really a dial, but you get the idea. It's a set of steps, it looks like, ma'alot. Today we use the term ma'alot to be degrees anyway. But now look at Malachim. Malachim Aleph, Perek Chaf, chapter 20, sentences 9 to 11. Vayomer Yeshayahu, and Yeshayahu said, Zelecha ha'oz me'ez Hashem. If you have the source sheet, I think I actually put it on your source sheet. Yes, I did. You know, look at source number 4 on your sheet. I actually gave you the passage there. I didn't translate it. Yeshayahu said, this is a sign from Hashem. Ki asa Hashem es hadavar asher diber, that God is going to do what He said He would do. Halach hatzel eser ma'alos. The shadow has gone 10 degrees. Im yashuv eser ma'alos. Will it go back 10 degrees? Vayomer Chizkiyahu, and Chizkiyahu said, Nakel latzel lintos eser ma'alos. He says, the shadow can easily go, you know, incline 10 degrees. Lo, ki yashuv hatzel achoranis eser ma'alos. He says, it's not the same thing for it to go back 10 degrees. It's easy for it to incline 10 degrees. It is not easy for it to go back 10 degrees. That's what he says. Vayikra Yeshayahu hanavi al Hashem. So Yeshayah calls to God. Vayashav es hatzel b'malos asher yarda b'malos achazach haranis eser malos. And sure enough, went back 10 degrees. That is Malachim. What are the big differences between the Yeshayah version and the Malachim version? So in the Yeshayah version, Chizkiyahu is not a player. Right? Yeshayah says, here's what's going to happen, and it happens. In the Malachim version, Yeshayah says to him, the shadow has gone 10 degrees. Can it go back 10 degrees? Question mark. Will it go back 10 degrees? Could it go back 10 degrees? And Chizkiyahu says it could incline 10 degrees. That's not the same thing as having it go back 10 degrees. There's a conversation going on here. And as is understood by the translators and commentators, it's actually a negotiation. In which Yeshayah says to him, what would you like? Choose your poison. Can it go back 10 degrees? And he says, well, I don't know. It could incline 10 degrees. I don't think it could go back 10 degrees. And Yeshayah says, watch this. And that's what happens. What in the world is going on? Why do I have two different versions of this? And how do I understand the version of it that's going on in Malachim? And then look at Divrei HaYamim, the last sentence that I brought you in source number 4. Divrei HaYamim just gives me this one-line reference, and that's it. Bayamim Ahim, in those days, Chalach Chizkiyahu ad lamut. Chizkiyahu was sick to the point of being deathly ill. Vayispalel al Hashem, he davened to God. Vayomer lo, and he said to him, umofes, he said, meaning to Chizkiyahu, umofes nasam lo, and he gave him a sign. That's it. He gave him a sign, beginning, middle, and end. What are we supposed to make of any of this? I mean, there's so much here that is strange. If this is a negotiation, right? If this is a negotiation, what's the point of Yeshayah asking Chizkiyahu to call the miracle, the way it appears in Malachim? Like, what exactly is the point? Why would he ask him a question? Why not just do what you're going to do? Right? What does it remind you of? What do you mean?
When he was negotiating about the story.
Yeah, but he doesn't ask for a sign there. This is a negotiation about a miracle. We have a story in Chumash with a negotiation about a miracle.
The one that we talked to before.
No.
The man down before he went on me to fight. Like, show me, he showed me the show me, like, the sign on the floor of the threshing field.
Now, you're talking about Gidon, right? Gidon is one.
Gidon
is one, and who else? In the Chumash. Moshe and Paro. Right? Moshe and Paro. Tell me. You know, when do you want the hail to stop, Paro? When do you want God to get rid of the frogs? What? I hate to say it, because Chizkiyahu isn't going to want to play Paro in this story. but what is this about? And why doesn't this whole negotiation show up in the version in Yeshaya? So that's in terms of the negotiation. And then the miracle itself. Did God, what exactly did God do to make the sunlight go back 10 degrees? What does that mean? How do you make sun go back 10 degrees?
Make the time go backwards or something.
Oh boy. Well, if it were really time travel, then Chizkiyahu wouldn't know that it had happened.
You covered the really cloud. Why? Because it's a cloud.
Yeah, so Joyce says maybe God uses a cloud in order to deflect the sunlight. That's one possibility.
But it's not going back. It's only covering.
Correct. And that's what we'll have to see. What exactly is this? Is there a message in the choice of sunlight and shadow as a sign? Like, why is this a sign? Why choose this? Of all the things God could have done.
Can I try something?
Yeah.
So, like, in Yoshua, when it says Shemesh Tegivondom,
yes.
You know, some of the questions say that it wasn't literally that the sun stood still, but that Hashem gave Yoshua more power or more time to get done what he needed to get done. And you kind of have a similar thing here, that he's being given extra time in his life to get done what he needs to get done. So
right.
It's more of a path than the miracle itself.
Good. So we're going to definitely need to talk about that symbolism. That is definitely a possible element here. I have another problem. If this is, one second, Susan. If this is the way that it sounds, which is a miracle involving the sun stopping, or even better, retreating, why does Divrei Hayamim give me just, yeah, there was a sign. There was a mofet. I mean, this is something you have to talk about. This is not something that you just say, oh yeah, there was... He told him you're going to live longer, and then there was a sign, and you know, let's get on to the next story. Like it doesn't make any sense, Susan.
I'm just confused because do we try to always find natural causes for every miracle?
Who said anything about natural causes?
Well, when you're trying to explain, when you're trying to explain, why would you bother to try to explain this miracle if you didn't just accept it as a miracle?
I'm not trying to explain it. I'm trying to understand what happened. I just want to know literally what happened. I'm not trying to explain it. We will get to commentators who do try to explain every miracle in a natural way. We're going to get there. But right now, all I want to know is just literally, if I were standing there, what would I have seen?
Wouldn't you have seen suddenly your own shadow going back and not seeing your shadow?
I don't know. And even with that, there are a lot of different ways that I could read that. Was it local? Was it global? Unclear. Extremely unclear. I have another problem. How many clocks do you think they had around? I mean, these sundial type clocks. What?
Did they have sundials by then?
Yes. But how many do you think they had lying around?
Not many. It was a big thing. They have to go out to look at the sundial.
You think so?
Well, the people wouldn't have their houses. Stupid.
I'm sure everyone could make it. It's so simple. Even other people.
See,
my
question is this: Why are you stating it was Ma'alot Achaz, specifically Achaz's sundial or clock or whatever this thing is? You mentioned Achaz. Achaz is not just somebody whose name you throw out there. He's Chizkiyahu's father, who Chizkiyahu broke with. Right? Achaz was the one who did not have emunah. He did not have faith. Why are we suddenly naming him in this story? I think there's a message here. Oh, right. You were going to say?
I said that we were talked about that before, that Abba Manel said that it's not a miracle. and the chizuk of the emanut of the emanut of his yeah.
Right. So we have to see. And I have one other question. If you look at your sheet in source number 5, this is from Divrei Hayamim. The next story that's showing up in Yeshaya is a visit from delegates who appear to be from Babel, from Babylon. We'll talk about who they are eventually. But look at the account in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles. V'chein b'mlitzei sarei Babel ha-mishalchim alav lidrosh ha-mofet asher hayab ba'aretz. Regarding the Babylonian representatives who came to him to seek information about the mofet, the sign that occurred in the land. In other words, it sounds like the Babylonians were aware of whatever happened here. This was not a local event. This had to be something bigger. But what? And if that's really true, then again, why did Divrei Hayamim, in the sentence in source number 4, just say, Mofet Natan Lo, he gave him a sign? This is, if this is big enough that Babel is aware, how in the world are you burying this story? It's a Mofet, it's a sign. So, this is something we're clearly going to have to spend a lot of time on after Shavuot at this point, because we're not having a class next week.